This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a couple of interesting interviews on today's program, a really fascinating story out of China about how the Chinese are using their nation's fishermen as an extension of their navy. Jeremiah Jacques has written an article about an incident that occurred just off the coast of the Philippines and how China took over a shoal by using these fishermen and in a way that nobody wanted to put up a fight over. But the effect is just the same as if they'd taken it over militarily. It's quite a picture of how aggressive China is becoming on the seas, but also how canny, how smart it's being about it. We'll also talk with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about a cloning project that took place in a Chinese lab, cloning a couple of monkeys, and they're using this to try to get to cures to major diseases like Alzheimer's. But as we'll talk about, they're ignoring some important ethical considerations. But I wanted to start the show today by just going through a few news items that may pique your interest, a couple of stories here that give a bit of an idea of the religious orientation of the world around us. You know, these technologies like Google Home and Amazon's Alexa, you can talk to these devices to access information available on the internet. We've all gotten accustomed to Googling things. My kids, when we're talking about things, you mention a concept or an animal or whatever the case might be, you instantly can find out, you can satisfy your curiosity by looking it up online and getting the answer. Well, a few days ago, the story emerged that Google Home was actually ignorant about a pretty basic subject. I'm going to just play an excerpt of a report from Fox 17 News in Nashville, Tennessee.
Sorry, thanks for telling me.
David Sams owns one and an Amazon Echo. Both give two different answers when asking, who is Jesus Christ?
Okay, Google, who is Jesus?
My apologies. I don't understand.
I even asked Google, who was David Sams? Google knew who I was. But Google did not know who Jesus was. Google did not know who Jesus Christ was. And Google did not know who God was.
Smart speakers are a technology owned by about 40 million Americans. That's about 1 in 6. And this religious conversation at home is making waves on social media. Comments, videos, and test results posted asking who is Jesus. The general response from Google Home is, I'm not sure how to help you with that. Still no response from the Google company on why.
So Google knows all about the prophet Muhammad. It knows about Buddha. It even knows about Satan. But it seems that someone somewhere in that company felt it was important to leave this information out. There was actually a Google spokesperson who talked to Fox 17 News after that story aired, and this is what the Google spokesperson said. The reason that Google Assistant didn't respond with information about who is Jesus or who is Jesus Christ wasn't out of disrespect, but instead to ensure respect. Some of the assistant's spoken responses come from the web, and for certain topics, this content can be more vulnerable to vandalism and spam. If our systems detect such circumstances, the assistant might not reply. If similar vulnerabilities were detected for other questions, including those about other religious leaders, the assistant also wouldn't respond. We're exploring different solutions and temporarily disabling these responses for religious figures on the assistant. So I don't personally see how there'd be anything controversial in giving a basic definition of who Jesus was. I just looked up Wikipedia. This is basically all correct, non-controversial information on Wikipedia. Jesus, also referred to as Jesus of Nazareth and Jesus Christ, was a Jewish preacher and religious leader. He's the central figure of Christianity. Most Christians believe him to be the incarnation of God, the Son, and the awaited Messiah or Christ prophesied in the Old Testament. So there you go, in case you couldn't find out who Jesus was from your Google Home device. That's a little public service that I am providing to you, our listeners. Another story here. There's been a very interesting fallout from the sex scandals in the United States, and that is a record number of female candidates running for office in 2018 for the first time. The cover story of the New York Magazine, it says 390 women are planning to run for the House of Representatives, a figure that's higher than at any point in American history. 22 of them are non-incumbent black women. For scale, there are only 18 black women in the House right now. The cover of the New York Magazine has this quote on it from one of these women. It says, "My 16-year-old turned to me after the election, and he said, 'America doesn't want a smart, qualified woman in office.' By Friday, I was running." So a lot of these women, they've been energized by the election of Donald Trump, or I guess the loss by Hillary Clinton. And they feel like it's time for women to smash through that glass ceiling, or at least take over more positions of power. This article says 49 women are likely to be running for the Senate, more than 68% higher than the number who'd announced at the same period in 2014. So we're talking about a very rapid change. The new cover of Time magazine has a picture of a bunch of these women who are running for office, and the title on the cover is "The Avengers. First they marched, now they're running." This is from the article by Charlotte Alter. She wrote, "Call it payback, call it a revolution, call it the pink wave, inspired by marchers in their magenta hats and the activism that followed. There is an unprecedented surge of first-time female candidates, overwhelmingly Democratic, running for offices big and small, from the U.S. Senate and state legislatures to local school boards." It says at least 79 women are exploring runs for governor in 2018, potentially doubling a record for female candidates set in 1994. The number of Democratic women likely challenging incumbents in the U.S. House of Representatives is up nearly 350% from 41 women in 2016. Roughly 900 women contacted Emily's List, which recruits and trains pro-choice Democratic women about running for office from 2015 to 2016. Since President Trump's election, more than 26,000 women have reached out about launching a campaign. 26,000 women. And so it says here in this Time magazine article, progressive women described undergoing a metamorphosis. In 2016, they were ordinary voters. In 2017, they became activists, spurred by the bitter defeat of the first major female presidential candidate. Now, in 2018, these doctors and mothers and teachers and executives are jumping into the arena and bringing new energy to a Democratic Party sorely in need of fresh faces. Quite an interesting development here. The idea seems to be that the country is not ready for a woman. They want to do something about that, and maybe a certain amount of the idea that men have proven themselves incapable and that the solution is for women to lead. And some of these candidates are explicitly saying just that. They're saying, you know, men can't do the job. We need to step in. And one of them, I saw an ad a while back where a woman said, you know, "You're never going to have a sex scandal with a woman in power. You don't have to worry about what's going on under the desk or anything of that nature." But it's almost as if men are the only ones that have human nature, that women don't, which is obviously a very terribly shallow view. But if you want more information about this, I would encourage you to go onto thetrumpet.com. We have an article from a couple of issues back of the Trumpet magazine called "The Antidote to Toxic Masculinity." And it is describing just how the solution to so many of these problems that we see is not less of the right kind of masculinity. It's actually more of a biblical masculinity. And it is more of men taking responsibility that we should take, that God has given us to take. You can find that article on thetrumpet.com. And there's also, it's also very strongly prophesied just how much this shift from a male dominated society to a female dominated society would characterize our time in this very end time. You can read about that in the third chapter of the prophet Isaiah, and we're seeing that unfold very dramatically. Here's a third story about prayer. Does prayer work? We actually hear quite a lot about prayer in public life these days, even public officials talking about praying for those who are affected by crises and cataclysmic events. The question is, do those prayers make any difference? Is God listening? There's an excellent article from last week on thetrumpet.com on this subject by trumpet writer Callum Wood. The title is UK Poll, God Seems Not to Be Listening. It says market research consultancy Comraise surveyed 2,069 people across the United Kingdom in early December on the subject of prayer. The overarching question that emerged from the poll was, is God listening? You know, that's a good question. What's the point of praying if the prayers aren't being heard? But if the prayers are being heard, then why do we continue to see so much trouble and so many problems in the world? It's kind of a paradox there. Looking at the state of our planet, this article continues, it's easy to see why many are skeptical. Weather disasters are breaking records. Many languish in poverty and illiteracy. Wars rage on most continents, and the doomsday clock ticks close to midnight. Is this because God cannot hear us? Or does he hear and refuse to answer? Or is there another explanation? So some results from this poll, half of adults in the UK, 51%, say they ever pray. So that might sound like a lot of people, but it actually says that one in five, 20% of UK adults say they pray regularly, which is defined as at least once a month. So about 60% of the people who pray don't even pray once a month. And praying once a month is considered praying regularly. Of those who pray, just 18% believe strongly that God hears their prayers. 18% strongly believe God hears them. 12% believe God does not. 36% are unsure. These are the people who pray. Nearly half of those who pray aren't sure or they don't believe that God hears them. Another question from this poll, can God answer your prayers? Of those who do pray, 16% said strongly that he can answer. Only 16%. So presumably, 84% of those aren't very strongly convinced that God can even answer their prayers, which is just tremendous. That's a tremendous number. But the question of whether God is actually answering our prayers, again, it's a legitimate question. You remember U.S. President Donald Trump calling for a day of prayer after Hurricane Harvey hit. And right after that day of prayer, then America was hit by Hurricane Irma, the worst Atlantic hurricane in history. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote an article in our November 2017 edition called Is God Answering America's Prayers? And he makes some very important points in that article, mostly about how important it is that we pray to God in a repentant attitude, that we actually repent. It's not just a matter of talking to him. It's a matter of turning to him and trying to obey him. Of those who were surveyed in that poll in the UK, only 23% had ever confessed their sins and asked for forgiveness, less than one out of four. So if you're interested in this subject, you'll be happy to know we're actually working on a new booklet about how to pray. The Bible says a lot about this. It reveals that there are actually keys to having your prayers answered. It's a very important subject. There's no more important relationship you can have in your life than with the God who hears and answers prayers. So look for that booklet. Keep your eyes out for that. And in the meantime, you can go to thetrumpet.com and read these two articles. The one from Gerald Flurry, Is God Answering America's Prayers? And this newer article, this from last week from Callum Wood, UK Poll, God Seems Not to Be Listening.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China has the largest navy in the world. It also has the largest coast guard. But it also has another presence on the waters of the globe, reinforcing these two official maritime forces. China has the world's largest fishing fleet. Well, what does that have to do with anything? The way that China is using these fishermen actually gives quite an amazing picture of just how aggressive China is being in flexing its power, particularly on the high seas. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello.
Hello there.
So there are people who are looking at this and they're saying that these fishermen, these Chinese fishermen, are actually functioning as a third arm of China's navy, or a maritime militia. What's the evidence that they have to support that claim?
That's right. Yeah. Several times over the years, I've read stories about Chinese fishermen bullying a Vietnamese Coast Guard ship, for example, or Philippine fishing fleet, or maybe South Korean merchant ships. And I always just sort of assumed that these were random, you know, patriotic, maybe Chinese fishermen just acting of their own volition. But the real picture, the truth, is much more sinister. They really are, as you said, a third arm of China's naval presence. And they are organized and trained and controlled, really directed by China's army, the People's Liberation Army. And the evidence for this mostly is apparent when you look at specific instances where China has been able to take territory from other nations. For example, if you look at the Scarborough Shoal today, that's it's within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. That's a zone that the United Nations Law of Sea defines as, well, it's a 200 nautical mile area surrounding a country's coast. And so that should be Philippine land. The Scarborough Shoal is about, it's about, 120 nautical miles from the Philippines. So it's well within that exclusive economic zone. But back in 2012, some Chinese fishermen went to the shoal, the Scarborough Shoal there, and by the time that some Philippine authorities were able to go to the area and try to make some arrests because they were not only in an area that doesn't belong to China, but they were also harvesting endangered wildlife. And so it was, there were several different facets of the illegal behavior there. But these fishermen worked with the Coast Guard vessels. The Chinese fishermen worked with the Chinese Coast Guard, and they ended up cordoning off the area and blocking the Philippine ships from being able to enter it. And eventually some Chinese People Liberation Army vessels came onto the horizon as well. So you have all three branches of China's naval fleet, really. The official Navy, the Coast Guard, and then these fishermen, which are an unofficial extension of it. And the three of them each played a vital role in what ended up being a 10-week long standoff between the Philippines and China.
And it was the fishermen who were sort of the advance guard of this.
Exactly. Yes, the fishermen were the very first ones there. And it's clear in hindsight that the Chinese government organized this entire thing to be a land grab. And the fishermen were sent in as the advance guard. You know, they were the first ones on the scene. And after 10 weeks, the United States brokered what they thought would be an agreement for a return to the status quo ante, or the situation before that standoff. As part of that agreement, the Philippine ships ended up backing off, but the Chinese vessels stayed there. And ever since then,
even though the agreement was that everyone would back off, China said, "Yeah, we'll back off," but they just didn't.
Exactly. Yes. So they didn't honor their end of the bargain. Mm-hmm. And to this day, China now owns the Scarborough Shoal, thanks in large part to those fishermen. You know, if it had been from the very beginning, if China had sent in PLA ships or even Coast Guard vessels, I think there would have been a weighty response from the United States or the Philippines, or you know, international bodies would have taken some action against that. But since it started off as a really low-key squabble between mm-hmm. fishermen, it was able to happen very gradually. And But it did equate to a land grab for China.
So that's really the issue, isn't it? That the way that these fishermen are being deployed in situations like this, it's lending a plausible deniability to the Chinese government to be able to make these moves. Like you said, had they done something that was more directly involved with the Navy or the Coast Guard, it would have provoked a much stronger international response. But they're using this in a very canny way that essentially gives other nations enough cause to say, well, we don't want to wage war over something so petty or something so minor.
That's exactly right. Yes. Using these fishing fleets gives Beijing a degree of deniability. You know, they can say these are just random fishermen doing what they want to do. They're not acting on our orders, on China's orders. And then also the civilian status of these fishermen complicates the rules of engagement for U.S. naval vessels or for Coast Guard personnel from the Philippines or Vietnam or South Korea or for any other official government entity that's trying to combat this illegal behavior. So really, Beijing is able to keep these kinds of skirmishes in the gray zone, which just means sort of in a place between war and peace, which there is, you know, there is a conflict, but the conflict occurs, it sort of stays just beneath the threshold of a conventional warfare.
Yeah.
And so in the gray zone, China is able to really just take advantage of that deniability and that quasi-civilian status, and it can prevent other powers from reacting to these land grabs.
What's the size of the fishing vessel militia that we're talking about here?
Well, there are over 6 million fishermen who operate in boats in China. Mm-hmm. And then there are about 2,600 vessels that are equipped to go into deep water.
Okay.
So that means outside of China's exclusive economic zone. So it's a pretty vast fleet.
I suppose, in a sense, it doesn't necessarily matter how many of them there are, because it wouldn't take that many of those vessels to do along the lines of what you're describing here at these Filipino shoals, get the job done. The other branches of the military are there on the horizon to ensure that everything goes according to their plan. But what you're describing here, it just reminds me a lot of the kind of strategy that we've seen deployed by Russia in these instances, where it's sort of this, you know, they're taking yards of territory at a time, and they're doing it with unmarked individuals or vehicles. So it's not like an official military excursion, and yet when it's all said and done, it accomplishes the same purpose.
Yeah, that's right. It's been referred to as salami slicing, because, as you said, they're just taking yards at a time. If you look at Russia's activity in Georgia, for example, over the last several years, they've been slowly pushing the border down just a few yards at a time, basically expanding the territory that Russia controls. And also, if you look at the way Russia took Crimea from Ukraine back in 2014, Putin did not accomplish that illegal land grab with an overt military invasion. Mm-hmm. Instead, he sent in Russian troops with all the insignia taken off of their uniforms and the signage removed from their vehicles. And these came to be nicknamed Little Green Men. Everybody knew that they were Russian troops, but since the insignia was removed, Putin and the other officials there in Russia were able to deny official Russian involvement. You know, people were saying, everyone knew what they actually were, but Putin would say, you know, these are, maybe they're Crimean vigilantes. Maybe these are mercenaries. Maybe this is just an unsanctioned adventure by a local commander, things like that. And so the lack of insignia and Moscow's flat denial that they were Russian troops was enough to just kind of inject a moment's hesitation into any kind of possible response from Kiev or from NATO.
So what do you make of this, the fact that, say, the Russians and the Chinese are using these tactics that, like you said, everyone knows what's going on, and yet the fact that they're doing it in this surreptitious way It gives them this deniability, even though there's no substance to the denials. What does it tell you about, say, the fact that they're playing the international community in this way and they're doing it successfully?
Well, it just shows that the world is difficult to defend. You know, when you have revisionist powers like Russia and China reverting to really shadowy hybrid warfare type tactics, these are not overt military adventures or operations. And because they're shadowy, because they're hybrid, it's very difficult for a power like the United States, which has tried to police the world, to really be able to combat it, because it's just, there's always going to be a pushback if the world views the U.S. as countering what could be seen as civilians. Mm-hmm. And so it just complicates the rules of engagement considerably.
Yeah. I suppose people are looking for evidence that the United States is the aggressor in any given situation, right, to begin with. And so if Russia or China, they play their cards right in these types of scenarios, basically these other nations are saying, well, we don't want to risk war over something so petty.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. We don't want to risk going to war over what is essentially a bunch of rocks in the South China Sea. That's what some analysts have said, but it's actually quite a dangerous mindset, because when you allow it to happen a little bit of this salami slicing, all it really does is encourage these revisionist powers to keep on pushing against the status quo.
Well, let's talk about that and put this in the bigger picture of China, what China is trying to accomplish. And we've drawn quite a bit of attention to its activities in the South China Sea, and even the way that it's seeking to control sea gates, and it's gaining access through some of these major transit points and trade around the world. Help us to see, say, what it's doing with these fishing vessels in that context.
Sure. Yes. Well, the fishing vessels do help China assert control over the South China Sea. And that's, it's an area almost the size of India. About a third of the world's maritime trade passes through there. It's a very strategic and important part of the world that just so much stability and trade depends upon it. And so the United States for decades has really safeguarded that area and just kept it as an open shipping lane, kept the shipping lanes opened. And so now China is basically intimidating these nations of Southeast Asia with its fishing fleets and with other types of activity into submitting to China's will. And so it really equates to a Chinese takeover of this vital, huge area, and it could threaten world trade in a very significant way.
So if people wanted more information about just understanding what China is doing here and why we're so focused on it, looking at it even from the standpoint of the prophecies of the Bible, how would you direct them?
We have an article written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. This was written in 2016, in our July 2016 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. And it's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And this article is very powerful. We'll have a link to it in our show notes. But Mr. Fleury just really shows how China's aggressive activity in this strategic area is pushing the world toward war, because it's threatening these vital shipping lanes. And he points to several Bible prophecies that are being fulfilled with this Chinese land grab, really. In the book of Deuteronomy, for example, God issues a very solemn warning to the nations of Israel, explaining that if they reject him, he'll hand control over the world's strategic sea gates to their enemies. That passage there in Deuteronomy 28:52 says, "He shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted, throughout your land." And Mr. Fleury explains that that's not just a warning for ancient people. That's really talking about modern day America. And that's proven in that article. So I would just encourage anyone who would like to know more about this to read that article by Mr. Fleury. And you can really see clearly with that it is fulfilling Bible prophecies in a sobering way.
It's a really fascinating subject. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China's fisherman fleet, which is functioning as something of a quasi-civilian navy. He's written an article called China's Fishing Fleets Are Fighting a Shadowy War to Expand the Country. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Really interesting stuff, Jeremiah. I'm glad that you looked into this and appreciate you sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You remember Dolly the Sheep? This was a sheep that was cloned over 20 years ago, back in 1996. It made a lot of headlines at the time. Scientists continue to try to advance their capability to clone things. Last year, researchers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences cloned two monkeys, according to research published last week. These efforts do raise some troubling ethical concerns. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So explain what these Chinese scientists did this past year with the monkeys.
Right. This is the first time they've ever been able to clone a monkey using the same technique that they used for Dolly the sheep. There was a case in 1999 where they had a monkey embryo, a macaque embryo, that they were able to artificially split into identical twins. And so the twins developed naturally, other than the fact that embryo split was done by science. But this same technique as Dolly the sheep, it's called somatic cell transfer. And I guess to just quickly summarize it, it's basically where you take a fertilized egg, but before it starts to divide, you suck the DNA out of it and throw that away, and then replace it with the DNA from another cell, like a skin cell, and then put it into a surrogate mother to come to term. And you get more or less a clone of the DNA in that skin cell. Like I said, this is something they did with Dolly the sheep, and they've done it with horses and pigs and cattle and things like that since then. But have never been able to actually get it to work on a monkey due to some of the more complicated genetics there.
What are they trying to accomplish with this?
Well, their stated purpose is they're trying to do research for like Alzheimer's disease and other diseases on people that they want to use animal testing for some of these drugs to see what the drug does to the animal. And but sometimes those drugs will... animals will respond to those a little differently based on their different genetic code. So the thought is like, well, if we can clone a bunch of them, then we'll have like one test subject with multiple, however many multiple trials we need.
Hmm. So what is it that's of concern as people are watching what's happening here, the results that these scientists are getting? What ethical considerations are being overlooked?
Well, pretty much any animal rights movement is very much against this, just due to the fact that because people don't really know much about genetics, none of these animals are born healthy. Actually, 96% of them don't even make it past 6 weeks from birth before they die. And even a lot of the ones that live longer than that have big heads or kidneys that don't function or some other malformity. So there's an animal cruelty aspect there people are concerned about. And then there's also the concern, though, that they could start using this technique on people. The scientist who cloned these monkeys had thought this. I said, well, now that we've done monkeys, we think it's at least technically possible to use this technique on people as well. That's banned in most nations. I don't think it's banned in China, though.
That's the way that so many of these breakthroughs are happening in China, isn't it? Because they're not as restrained by some of the legal restrictions.
Right, and China's, I guess, it's an officially an atheist state, but it's also Confucianism is very prevalent there, and both ideologies don't actually regard a human as a person until they're born, as opposed to Christianity, which regards that from conception. It uses the Bible truth that life begins at conception. And so the political discussion about doing experiments like this on a human embryo are less controversial in Eastern cultures.
That really is the issue, isn't it? That it's we're talking about different religious ideas or different religious assumptions that would lead you to say this is okay or this is not okay. If a scientist is looking at an embryo as like a glob of cells, the way that it tends to be viewed, even in the West, and the way that we've established our abortion laws, then what's to inhibit using them for whatever purposes that you might want to, especially if the rationale is that, well, this could help us to eliminate diseases like Alzheimer's.
Right. If you take the Bible at its word that this unborn human being is human and it is living and it is made in the image of God, then its life is sacred and there's no excuse to kill it. But if you're coming at this from other religious traditions or an atheist tradition that it is just a glob of cells, then you figure like, okay, well, maybe we'll kill off this embryo. But if that helps us develop a cure for Alzheimer's or some other disease, then that's worth it in the long run. The ends justify the means.
And even it seems like the biblical view of the way that we should treat animals kind of factors into this, that there is a certain respect for life in general, the way that the Bible would view it, that would look askance at scientists creating animals that with misshapen heads and that were unable to survive beyond a few weeks, where a scientist who's not considering those types of ethical considerations is not going to be restrained by that.
Right, because that's from Proverbs 12 and verse 10, where it says, "A righteous man regards the life of his beast, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel." And that's something where obviously the Bible has chapters on what meat is clean to eat, so you can kill animals. They're not made in the image of God like people are. But still, when you do that, I mean, you treat them well when you raise animals for food, and when you kill them in the quickest, most merciful way possible. Nothing like these experiments where they're taking embryos and during the cloning process, they know that there's something about that process they don't understand that shuts down a number of genes that are vital for health. The kidneys seem to get influenced a lot, where now you've got your blood's not being filtered correctly because you weren't produced in the natural way, and you've got all these health problems with high acid content in your blood burning inside you. And it's almost like torturing these these poor baby monkeys for really no good reason. If they're if the world needed more monkeys, monkeys know how to make them. If the world needs cures from diseases, well, the Bible has quite a bit to say about that as well. I mean, God designed all living things, and he designed them to be healthy. And if you follow his laws, his health laws, his moral laws, health is a natural result of that. And so many of these diseases, or actually all of diseases you see around the world, are the result of a broken health law in some way or another. It might be your parents' generation, might be things you've done. But that's the key to good health, not torturing monkeys with drug trials and cloning techniques and whatever else they do to those poor things to try to come up with cures to diseases that have much better biblical solutions to.
Well, it is interesting to consider the history of how much science has gotten into these areas where they're if you remove, say, biblical, ethical, and moral considerations from the equation, and you're looking at it purely from a following our curiosity wherever it may lead, absent any kind of restraint, science has really gotten itself into some pretty murky territory repeatedly throughout history, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, probably the most extreme example comes to mind is there were a lot of medical research done in Nazi Germany on not monkey test subjects, but human test subjects. Once you get into this thinking that not every life is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you just get some horrible things you don't even really want to even bring up on air. We get some of the concentration camps and Dr. Mengele. You get down there. And some of these things, I mean, that is kind of a concern with this cloning as well. As like I said, this is banned in most nations. They do still do stem cell research on human embryos, and that's done on those are done on fertilized embryos, which are human beings. They know they're artificially fertilized and grown outside of a mother, so they can't survive very long. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that is kind of like one of the big ethical concerns as you start implanting one of those embryos in a surrogate mother, like you did with these monkeys, and then you've got a human being born with a deformed head and kidneys that don't function. In your quest to skirt around God's health laws and find a medical cure that allows you to keep breaking those laws without consequence.
Well, let me ask you this, Andrew: if somebody is a lot of people already have their minds made up about this type of a question. You know, when does life begin? Is human life sacred? And it would be difficult to say, you know, influence someone's thinking beyond, you know, maybe moving the needle a little bit. To convince someone that human life is in fact sacred. But if you could say either give them the argument that they need to consider, or put a booklet in their hand, or something that would answer that question. Maybe even to the person who doesn't know, you know, and maybe wants to look into it more. What would you tell them?
Well, I definitely say that as far as regarding an unborn baby or a human embryo as a human life should be straightforward, even from a scientific standpoint. I mean, it's human. It's not a bush baby or a rutabaga or a carrot. Just by process of elimination, you can reason out that this is human. And you are killing it because, I mean, you know how cells, what a living cell looks like. It's not, this shouldn't be news to scientists that this is a living human embryo. Now, as to whether human life is any more sacred or any more special than animal life, that does really rest a lot on your, or almost completely on your faith in the Bible. And we do have actually a really short booklet, wouldn't take long to read, I think only about 20 pages by Herbert W. Armstrong, What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind, where... Yeah, for a 20-page booklet, it's really powerful just going through the difference between the human mind and the animal mind and the verses in the Bible that talk about the spirit component to the human mind. It even goes really in-depth in, to like the physical spiritual parallels between human reproduction and spiritual conversion. That gives you a lot more depth in explaining when does human life begin, and like the fertilization process between a sperm cell and an egg cell that's so important in this cloning process is something that God actually designed to teach us about the conversion process when you receive God's Holy Spirit combining with your human spirit, a spirit that animals don't have, and that explains why human beings have things like free will and the ability to have a personal relationship with God and the ability to reason out rationally and logically in a way that monkeys or no other animal possesses, even though physically their way their brains work is not that much different from the way a human brain works physically.
Mm-hmm. What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind. You've got to recognize that there's a spiritual component here that can't be measured with scientific instruments and so on. But you can see it if you just look at the difference in output and mental faculties between human beings and animals. There's obviously a vast difference here.
Right, because you can, I mean, definitely if you look at like a fruit fly versus a chimpanzee, you can see physical differences there, why a chimpanzee would be able to do some more sophisticated things than a fruit fly, but you look at like a chimpanzee versus a dolphin versus a human, and like I said, physically it's really hard to tell why, like, what's these brains look almost the same. Why can a human write poetry and do advanced calculus and mathematics and come up with religions and pray to God and all these things that chimpanzees and dolphins don't do? Mm-hmm. There is no explanation for that. And I think in this book, What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind, Mr. Armstrong mentions even some of the scientists who have had to grudgingly admit that there is something that they can't discover about the human mind that seems to be more than physical.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are the kinds of questions that you just don't hear addressed in the scientific community as they're pursuing these types of projects, cloning and so on. So much of the time they're looking at, if they're trying to resolve mysteries that would enable them to cure a disease or find some way of addressing a disease, but they're overlooking some of these more basic questions. And yet, if you do step back and ask yourself, well, what is going on here? What is the difference between human beings and animals? Or is there something more that you cannot measure with a scientific instrument? Then you're going to be questioning the very foundation of the substance of those experimentations, those arguments, in a way that really is critical. And it's important that we look at those. What Science Cannot Discover About the Human Mind, that really is an excellent resource to look at in order to address some of those more fundamental questions. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about cloning and a couple of monkeys that were cloned in a Chinese lab just a couple of months ago, but he's working on an article on this subject. If you want to read that, just keep your eye out on thetrumpet.com for this article by Andrew Miller. We appreciate your time, Andrew.
All right, thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
You're either smart or you're dumb. You're either good at math or bad at it. You're good at music or hopeless. You're a science guy or you're a language gal or you're a handyman or you're none of these things. This is the way that many people think. They think aptitude is fixed. They think if you try something and fail, that proves it's just not your thing. You're bad at it, admit it, and move on. Now, even if you don't say that, you might still be acting on this belief without realizing it. You see somebody else excel at a subject or a skill, and it's easy to think, well, that ability is natural talent. You see the skill, but you don't see the preparation, the practice, the time, the effort that the person invested to get that skill. You compare yourself to the end product, and you think, well, I just don't have that kind of ability. So you avoid that activity. You avoid that subject. And so, you know, your motivation weakens. Maybe if you're a student in school, you say, well, this just isn't my thing. You don't try as hard. You fall further behind. And so the idea that you're bad at something becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12 that it is unwise to compare yourself to other people. If you use other people as your measure, then you're going to tend to get discouraged if you just only look at those who are better than you, or you're going to become vain if you only look at people that you feel like you're better than. A real measure is the one that God gives us. He wants us to use His standards, and He wants us to keep our eyes locked on Him. But this is an interesting fact that has been proven in multiple studies, that students who believe ability is fixed don't tend to achieve as much as students who believe ability can change depending on effort. One study made this amazing discovery, that students who believe you can change your level of intelligence get higher grades than those who think that your IQ is set. There was another study that worked with some low-performing minority junior high school students. And they told them that intelligence is adaptable, that it grows when you work hard, Well, guess what? These students worked harder and their grades improved. Now, we're not talking just about the power of positive thinking. What those researchers told those students is actually true. It's been proven that you can actually increase your intelligence by working hard. The brain is very responsive when you put it to good use. It forges new connections. It becomes more capable. So the idea that you're doomed to stay dumb because, well, that's just the way you are, for most people, that is a lie. And it's a lie that traps people in failure. Now, of course, people have different natural tendencies that make some subjects or skills easier than others. But study after study has shown that the far greater determinant of success, many times over, is simply hard work. So if you struggle at math and you take that as a sign, well, you'll never be good at math, the chances are you'll prove yourself right. If you fail at something and you accept that result and never challenge it, then you're going to be stuck. Your motivation will tank. You're going to downshift your expectations and focus on just getting through that class and moving on, or just avoiding it altogether. Many, many people, from the time that they're young, do this. It's easy to do. Now, if you have thought this way, realize that it is never too late to break this cycle. If you study the life of any truly successful person, you're guaranteed to find a hard worker. You'll find someone who's still learning. They're still taking on new challenges. That's because success doesn't come any other way. Read the parable of the pounds in Luke 19. It's an amazing picture of how God expects each of us to make the most of the opportunities and the abilities that he gives us. God's way of life is a growth-oriented way. We all start out life knowing nothing. And growing up is a process of failing, trying again, stumbling, getting up, learning, picking up lessons and skills bit by bit. And when you take a positive approach to that process, even though it is sometimes a painful process, you build patience and persistence, determination, drive, resiliency, character. That's exactly what God wants. And he wants you to keep learning and growing and challenging yourself. And it's not just till you graduate high school or graduate college, but as long as you live. Research shows your brain actually grows by struggling over obstacles. It grows more by doing those hard things than by easy wins. There's actually physical evidence that God designed us to overcome and grow. So know that. Know the truth that you can improve. Don't accept failure. Struggle through the difficulties. Struggle through mistakes until you learn from them. When you're corrected, embrace that. It's the only way to improve. And when you do badly, adjust your approach and persist. When you fail, work harder. Don't quit until you succeed. Fight until you win. When you see somebody who's more accomplished than you, don't let that discourage you. See what you can learn from that person. This is the positive, growth-oriented approach to life that God wants to develop in you, no matter the skill or the subject. Proverbs 22:29 says, "See you a man diligent in his business, he shall stand before kings." So notice that. Success doesn't come by natural ability. Accomplishment doesn't depend on the smarts you were born with. God says it depends on diligence. Work hard in your business. Apply yourself, and you will grow. You will get more skilled, more successful, even smarter, and doors of opportunity will open. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on the program today, Jeremiah Jacques and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our staff as well, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Philip James Bailey. We live in deeds, not years, in thoughts, not breaths. He most lives who thinks most, feels the noblest, acts the best. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.